First, a few housekeeping items. You'll find at your tables some printed materials. These are meant not only to summarize what you'll be hearing from the panels, but also to provide some more in-depth analysis of some of the technical issues that we won't have time to go through with you tonight. Second, for the attorneys in the audience, we do expect that the session will qualify for CLE credit. If you'd like to get CLE credit, there are sign-up sheets just outside, adjacent to where the name tags were. Please be sure to sign out before you leave. Finally, we do encourage you to provide us feedback so that we can help make these as useful as possible. And also, if you have thoughts on specific topics that you'd like to hear about, please do let us know in those sheets. Finally, we hope you'll all stay to join us after the program is finished for cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, and we promise to get you out before the first pitch. Again, thanks for joining us, and I'll now turn it over to my partner, Bill Sturman, who will be moderating tonight's first panel on the role of secondaries in the private equity market.
Thanks, Steve. My name is Bill Sturman. I'm a partner at Aikens Investment Funds Practice, and as Steve said, the first panel that I'm going to moderate tonight is Role of the Secondary Markets and LP Trends. I'm joined on the panel by my partner, Fadi Saman, who is a partner in our Washington, D.C. office. Fadi's practice focuses on the domestic and international private investment funds industry, representing fund sponsors in connection with the organization, structure, and operation of private investment funds, including private equity funds, secondary funds, real estate funds, venture capital funds, fund of funds, and hedge funds. To Fadi's left is Brett Gordon. Brett is one of the leaders of HarbourVest's secondary investment team, which focuses on the purchase of U.S. and non-U.S. investments in limited partnerships and portfolios of direct investments. Brett joined HarbourVest in 1998 as an analyst after receiving his MBA, became a principal in 2003, and was promoted to managing director in 2008. We're also fortunate to have Carl Hartman on our panel. Carl is the chief operating officer of Franklin Park. Franklin Park offers institutional investors customized private equity solutions, including portfolio planning, investment manager selection, and portfolio management. Carl co-founded Franklin Park in 2003 and has 9 years of private equity industry experience. Previously, Carl was vice president at Hamilton Lane, where he was responsible for reviewing and negotiating all legal documentation for the firm's partnership investments and was a member of the due diligence group. Finally, we have Brian Mooney, all the way from Dallas, and Brian is a managing director and co-founder of Cogent Partners, a global leader in investment banking services for the secondary market, and has over 10 years of secondary market experience. Previously, Brian was part of the investment team at the Crossroads Group, where he focused on secondary acquisitions as well as primary and equity co-investments. So now that we have the housekeeping out of the way, first question I want to lead off is just talking about the secondaries market. There's been a lot of news about it and a lot of interest in secondary transactions. Has that translated into a lot of market activity in the space, Brett?
There's been a lot of activity. Deal flow for us, we continue to set record after record on a year-over-year basis. We had a record year in 2007 and saw about $30 billion of opportunities. In 2008, that was up to $59 billion. And this year, year-to-date, we're at about $46 billion and on track to set yet another record. The one thing I would say that differentiates this year over prior years is there's a lot of deal flow, but we don't have a lot to show for it. We have not transacted very much in the marketplace, given some of the dynamics, bid-ask spreads, uncertainty about assets, and really, you know, whether sellers are prepared to transact given the pricing. But there is a lot of activity. It's keeping us busy for sure.
Brian, do you agree with that? Is that what your experience has been?
Yeah, the market has been very active, certainly on the deal flow side. I think the general perception is that not a lot is actually closed. From our perspective, in the first half of this year, we sold more funds than we've ever sold in the first half of any prior year. So from our perspective, what has changed is the type of activity. The perception that nothing is closed is due to the fact there aren't any large deals that closed in big chunks. No one bought a billion-dollar portfolio. Billion-dollar portfolios were sold, but they were done in very small, unnoteworthy pieces. So for the first half of the year, on average, for every buyer we transacted with, we sold 2.2 funds to that buyer. And that's come down dramatically from 10 to 15 funds per buyer probably 5 or 6 years ago. So the nature of the activity has changed. And not a lot that has been newsworthy has hit the press. But the market in general has been fairly active. I don't think it'll be a record year for volume. Our estimate last year was 18 to 20 billion. And I think this year to date, we're at about 8.5 billion for the market.
Where are you seeing pricing these various secondary transactions? Is there a disconnect between buyers and sellers on prices?
There's a very large disconnect. That's why Brett's seen $45 billion and very little relative to that has closed. Pricing specifically for the first 4 months of the year hit a low. So in the first half of the year, average pricing was 40% of NAV. Most of that was driven by prices or bids being based off of 930 NAVs, which had yet to be marked down at year-end. First 4 months of the year, the equity markets were way down, very volatile, and most large pools of capital on the secondary side were sitting on the sidelines, not deploying significant capital. So we saw most deals getting done at depressed pricing, where buyers were pricing to their perception of the seller's distress rather than to the assets. Pricing has improved dramatically since then. I would say most assets, probably 85% of what we've been selling or pricing recently, has been pricing at 60 to 80% of Q2 NAV, which is almost a doubling in most cases of pricing from the first part of the year. So we've seen a dramatic improvement. The rally in the equity markets has helped. A lot of new capital on the buy side is helping drive a little bit of competition. And we're seeing buyers once again willing to underwrite to the assets.
And do you see how is liquidity in terms of investors? There have been a lot of talk about investors not having liquidity to fund their capital calls because of lack of distributions. Is that lack of liquidity going to keep driving this market, and people have to unload their interests?
As we see it, to me that's the key question that really changes the market. People, when you look at the assets that people are selling today, oftentimes it has a pretty significant unfunded component, and that is really them trying to sell out from underneath that unfunded component. I mean, you take a step back and you say, well, gee, most people's asset base has shrunk. The public markets are down, so their public equities are down. All other parts of their portfolio are down, except for the unfunded component of the private equity. So it is now a much bigger part of their overall portfolio. And as you look at the assets they're selling, they're clearly trying to sell out from under that. The reason, in our mind, people haven't transacted is because they don't need that liquidity right now. The people who needed liquidity transacted the end of last year, beginning of this year. Right now, they come to market, they look to try and sell. They don't like the pricing, but there are no capital calls, so they decide to wait. The interesting thing will be when those capital calls start, because the reality is many of the institutions who are trying to sell right now just won't be able to fund those capital calls.
How has the GP's attitude towards secondary buyers changed? And more question for you, Fadi, what role can or should or can the GP take in the secondary process if you have LPs that want to get out? And the GP obviously doesn't want to have a default. What should they be mindful of?
Yeah, it's an interesting development, I think, particularly in the past year. Secondary buyers have, in essence, become in many ways, solution providers to fund sponsors to deal with LPs who are in distress and perhaps having issues making capital calls or signaling to GPs that they may have issues in the near future. So I think, and two, the secondary market has grown, so GPs are becoming more and more cognizant of and viewing secondary buyers as partners, particularly those who also perhaps have a primary component to their investment program. The interesting challenge for GPs in those transactions, I think, is how involved do we get, and what are the risks for our involvement? my experience is practice kind of widely varies. I mean, you have some, and it depends on the context of the sale. I mean, where the buyer is coming in and effectively providing a solution, the GP is going to be much more willing to help, particularly on the due diligence side. I mean, one of the first things I do is caution. I mean, we really don't want GPs involved in pricing, negotiation. In terms of the deal between the buyer and the seller, really, we don't want the GP involved in that aspect. But where the question for the GP comes is the due diligence process. The buyer is really looking for as much information as it can get about the asset, and they're comes a tricky part of the analysis. How much information do I provide? And the information I'm providing perhaps wasn't designed to be presented in this context. I'm providing perhaps reports or information that I provide to my LPs on an informative basis, and now I'm providing it to someone who is effectively making an investment decision. And so one of the first things we definitely do seek from the buyers in these contexts is that they're not is a hold harmless or a big boy type rep, that they're not relying on this information, or they understand that this information is perhaps incomplete in terms of their reliance on the GP's information. And most buyers, Brett, I mean, I think don't have an issue with those kinds of reps as long as they're reasonably drafted, such that you know they're not completely disregarding false statements and those kind of matters, but. The question then becomes how much more information you get. What's your experience in terms of what GPs are doing?
You know, it depends on the GP. You know, we're in a slightly different position from the standpoint of our platform, because we have a large part of our business is a primary investment component. So many of the funds that we look at on the secondary side, we're already in those funds. We know these people. We have a lot of the information, so half the time we don't need the information. But even when we do need information, because of the nature of the relationship and our potential as a primary investor, more often than not, the GP is going to be very friendly and try and help us analyze the asset because they want us as an investor, you know, especially in this market. I would tell you 7-8 years ago, you know, that was something we presented to GPs all the time, saying, gee, why would you ever want a secondary-only buyer to buy your assets? They can't support you long-term, and it fell on deaf ears. Today, as the market has changed and GPs are really concerned about raising their next fund, you know, a buyer with a primary component is someone who's very attractive to them, considering that the reason they're getting this phone call is they're losing an investor.
And, Carl, I mean, you advise LPs in the secondary space, or, I mean, how do you... What's your experience?
It's similar to what Brett was just saying, that our LPs will not invest in secondaries, but on like a opportunistic basis, more or less, to help a GP that has a funding gap. So if there's a manager that we've supported with significant capital from our LP base, they have come to us and say, listen, we lost an LP. Are you interested in the secondary? And we'll do that on a one-off basis because it's a manager we know, we trust, we've allocated significant capital to. That's really the only time we'll play in the secondary market, is if it's somebody that we know and trust. We're not actively seeking it, but to expand the relationship with that manager, we'll do it.
And I'm sure, I mean, Brian, and you have to deal with this all the time, trying to get buyers access to the GPs and how tough that is.
Yeah, I think the one thing that's always true is it's very hard to generalize about how GPs are going to react to transfers. It's all about the personality and the egos around the table. What we found on average, though, is over time, GPs have become much more involved in secondary sales and opinionated, which can, you know, range from defining and mandating how confidential information is shared, who gets it, what types of buyers are approvable. That's the longer-term trend. The shorter-term trend has been with not a direct threat of default, but a lot of LPs having real liquidity issues. There's been much more cooperation from the GP community, where over the last 12 months, I can tell you many have been very helpful in finding buyers or replacement LPs for sellers in distress. And I think part of that is, you know, when sellers used to call GPs 5 or 6 years ago about a sale, it was really because they didn't like the fund anymore. They wanted to reallocate the capital. It was a strategic sale, going to focus on other core GPs. Today, the call from the LP is kind of like breaking up with your girlfriend or boyfriend. It's not you, it's me. So I think GPs, you know, that's resonated. And they've come a long way in being helpful. But I think the general, the long-term trend is, you know, more involved, more restrictive. If we give a GP a list of buyers that we would propose, all of them are going to cross somebody off the list. And in most cases, the category of groups that they'll cross off, and it's hard to generalize, would be the dedicated secondary pools of capital who can't, like HarborVest, provide, you know, potential source of capital on the next fund.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, I mean, it used to be GPs really had no interest in having funds transferred, but the alternative of having a default, as Steve Vine mentioned, in private equity, we never really worried about the default provisions because they were never applicable. That's not the case. I was curious to see just the panelists, their experiences with default. Have they seen them? And what are GPs doing to deal with potential defaults, which, in my opinion, it seems like there's a lot of talk about them, but in terms of actual defaults, I was curious as to...
Yeah, we really haven't seen any or many actual defaults.
I think the story is, you know, it's, we haven't seen as many actual defaults, but lots of, you know, threats, maybe a strong word, but discussions about, from LPs with their sponsors about potential liquidity issues. And most of the discussion seems to be focusing around slowing the rate of the capital calls in the near term while they address their liquidity issues. I think when there have been defaults, the challenge for the GP has been what to do. An LP doesn't show up with a capital call or says, look, I can't make it, but I can make it in 30 days. What do you do? And I think most GPs, and our advice to most of GPs is, look, the default provisions are there, but actually invoking them and going through them presents some challenges because in some ways it's a point of no return or potentially a difficult point to return from. And so we look for flexibility, I think, to try to seek a sale of the interest on, you know, to a group like HarborVest or others because it does provide a real clean and neat solution to the issue, replacing that LP with someone who stands ready to fund.
I mean, that's what we've seen as well. It's pretty rare that you actually see the interest technically defaulted, even though they've missed a capital call and sometimes are rather delinquent. It just doesn't make sense in most instances for the general partner to take it all the way to the finish line. But, you know, we've dealt with a number of sellers and a number of GPs where it's been awfully close, you know, where you know, to the point of, you know, this is what a default letter would look like, and so you understand what your, you know, the pain you would suffer should we put you into default. So as a GP, we strongly encourage you to work something out, you know, with this buyer or with this group of buyers if you have a week.
Well, it's one thing to note is it used to be defaults were isolated instances, so you could kind of deal with it and kind of be flexible and creative. One thing that GPs should keep in mind is that kind of can set the tone now for how you have to deal with future defaulting LPs. You've kind of, either through an MFN provision or just your fiduciary duty, kind of setting the course of action, so be very mindful on how that, one, you deal with that because it could be a domino effect. And I don't think that GPs in the past really had to deal with those potential issues. So it's a different time. But getting back, Brett, you do a lot of these transactions. What kind of deal structures are you seeing in the secondaries market? Are these just buyers just coming in and taking the remainder of the capital commitment, or are there more creative ways to deal with these?
You know, I think a market like this presents opportunities for lots of different ways to solve problems. And at the end of the day, you know, a deal structure is likely only put in place to bridge a gap between a buyer and seller's expectations, to solve some other type of problems. And, you know, as you think about the market we're in right now, structuring has been a big part of the proposed solutions that buyers are presenting. You know, anything from, you know, let us just take over the unfunded versus let us buy the actual interest, meaning sort of, you know, unscramble the egg, so to speak, and break apart the LP interest and just take one part or the other depending upon what a seller's objectives may be. We've seen a number of deals, we've worked on a number of deals where you are really, stepping into an LP's shoes only on the going forward piece, because again, they like the general partner, they like the assets, or perhaps don't like the discount they're going to get on the assets. But for them, it's much more of them relieving that unfunded obligation. And when you think about this market relative to the last downturn, coming out of the tech bubble, there were a number of deals done at that time as well that were really structure specific, very different from the traditional buy sell, take that LP out 100%.
Very interesting. And Ryan, same.
Yeah, the ratio of secondary deal flow to closing is actually much higher than structure deals to closing. There's been a lot of talk about it. They're very useful in certain specific situations to help a seller meet specific objectives, but they're broadly not applicable. One of the issues is, the typical structure that we see most groups pitching is, I'll help you meet your unfunded. Put $500 million of NAV in this SPV. We'll meet $500 million of capital calls for you. We'll get first money out, some preferred return, and we'll share the upside. So worst case scenario, all the capital is called the next day. And say you get dollar for dollar credit, NAV, for each capital call you make. So worst case, you've got 30% loan to value on the capital that's gone in from the buyer. The issue is that's really a mezzanine debt or debt structure, but most secondary funds are absolute return investors. And they can't really underwrite to a much lower risk level and justify that to their investors, because they're competing against other groups who are doing, equity-type returns. So for most LPs, that type of structure is not applicable. They can find cheaper capital if they like that type of structure, because it really is debt. So in most cases, we've seen those sellers who find something similar to that attractive look to more of the debt capital markets for a solution, or borrow against their broader portfolio, not just private equity specifically.
That's great. I want to kind of move on to just one thing I think everybody in this room is on their minds is just fundraising. And we all know that it's challenging. Fundraising is challenging, and raising money is very competitive. Are there any signs of life out there, Carl?
From the LP perspective, from the limited partner perspective, my personal opinion is we have a couple clients that are very new to the asset class, so they will be active investors in 2010, 2011. Our clients that had significant legacy portfolios, they are constrained. They are definitely constrained. Managing issues, as Brett described, public equity markets are down. The denominator effect has hit their portfolio, so they have significantly reduced their pace for 2009 and 2010. We have a client that typically would commit $100 million a year, is only committing $20 million a year now. So that has been significantly reduced. However, we are seeing both on the GP side, fund sponsor side, as well as the investor side, significant activity in Asia, which, is an old story, but it is really picking up from our perspective. You're seeing a lot more fund sponsors in Asia raising funds, RMB funds, et cetera. And then we've gotten significant calls from Asian investors looking for domestic funds. So that is an interesting area that we're hoping to develop over the next couple of years.
And so the hottest funds are the clean energy, the Asian funds, the distressed?
With respect to funds that are hot in the market now from the general partner's perspective, our approach is really very opportunistic. We're not a tactical investor, so we do not try to market time into the market, distressed or energy or infrastructure. We want to see the best 10 managers in any given year, because most of those managers are going to be investing over a life of 3 to 6 years. So it's very difficult to time the market while they're investing over a 3 to 6 year period. So we wanted to see the best 6 to 10 managers each year. It could be corporate finance, could be distressed, it could be venture capital. Those 6 to 10 managers in that vintage year is what we like.
Are you seeing a lot of new investors coming into the asset class?
The Asian investors we are seeing significantly, and then there are quite a few still domestic investors that haven't had allocation to private equity, that just recently made allocations to private equity. Typical governmental pension plans had usually been a 60-40 type of portfolio, 60% equities and 40% fixed income are now kind of expanding their portfolio into alternatives. So that is something we're seeing.
And with the public markets, with the rise in the public markets, is the reversal of the denominator effect that we've heard so much about, is that helping private equity allocations, target allocations?
The reversal, the run-up now?
Yeah.
It still remains to be seen because we're working off of old numbers in private equity, too. It lags significantly, so the values are starting to run up, and the denominators are starting to adjust a little bit, but I don't know if we're going to know the answer to that until year-end, probably.
One thing you hear a lot about are, on the investor side, are investor bill of rights or, you know, certain terms that investors now want to see in every both hedge fund and private equity fund. Is the panel seeing any traction with that?
I think, you know, it may be a little too early to tell, but we've definitely seen, I think probably a lot of people in this room are aware of the ILPA's PE principles that were released. And if you look through those, many of those are not new concepts, but they are perhaps concepts that have perhaps been muted during the golden era, so to speak, over the past 5 years. But what's interesting now, I think there's definitely a refocus on terms and alignment of interest. Of course, fees and carry are always important to investors, and that's not going to change. But I think what I found interesting is while those are important, the level of focus on governance-type issues in funds, conflicts of interest issues, diversification limits, style drift, leverage limitations, the core governance features of the fund that perhaps during the past 5 years have been less of a focus are really coming into investor focus, and they really are looking at why are they hiring this manager and making sure that the manager is really sticking to the game plan that they sold the fund on. And I think that's really, to me, I think that's where the focus actually will ultimately be in the next round of fundraising. I mean, of course, there'll be pressure on management fees and there'll be pressure on carry, but I think the real story will be on the tightening of the governance of private equity funds.
I mean, the tricky part becomes if these funds were raising the same amount of money that they raised last time around, I think they'd have a challenge and would be more willing to give on terms. But many of even the best funds are looking to raise half the money. So, you know, to the extent that those GPs can get half the money with similar terms to what they had last time around, they may not give. I mean, we've seen it before where you thought, you know, the pendulum would shift back to the LP in terms of power. And I think this time is different. We have seen a number of top-tier funds reduce economics, you know, focus much more on governance issues, which for so many of us are critical. You know, the question is, will it really get to where it should? And one of the governors to that may be just that, you know, they don't have to go as far as we would all like because they aren't raising as much capital.
Carl, you're an advisor to LPs. Do you echo those statements?
Yeah, I agree with those statements, and I would add one area that we're focused on is transparency in financial reporting. There's very limited standardization across the industry in how financial reports are kind of delivered to clients. I mean, you see basic financial statements, but you'd like to see calculations of unfunded commitments done on a consistent basis. We like to see invested capital in portfolio companies along with cost and market value, and then realized capital on a portfolio company level so that when we can report back to our clients, we can show more beyond just the capital account value. We can show how the portfolio is performing on a realized basis as well as kind of a cost and value basis. So what we're trying to push for is more transparency in the financial reporting area so that we can effectively show our clients how the managers are performing.
What are GP's reactions to your requests?
Very favorable at this point in time. They're very accommodating. It's a little bit more of education to show them kind of exactly what we need to show our clients. Transparency seems to be okay on the fees and all that. It's still a little bit of a battle. So,
yeah, I think we'll see better transparency over time. My own prediction is we'll see very little movement, if at all, on economic terms in partnership agreements. I think the LP community is so poor at organizing itself as a group. And there's so much institutional inertia at many of these LPs that there's just no reason for that individual who may be heading a private equity or CIO to really push any one specific GP, because it's not going to move the needle overall. That my prediction is fund sizes may get cut in half, but the supply-demand balances out, and GPs don't have to make significant cuts.
Yeah, it seems like on the fees, I mean, the carry isn't going from 20 to 15, and the management fees pretty much staying at 2%. You might see tension on the transaction fees and things of that nature. I saw a recent article where institutional investors indicated a preference for club deals as opposed to the standard fund because they were frustrated with so many LPs that they couldn't really get anything done. I was curious as to the panel's reaction to that philosophy.
We've seen an uptick in calls on club deals. I mean, our pledge funds or structures where capital is raised on a soft basis or semi-committed basis, but really investors have an opt-in, opt-out choice on each deal. And look, they sound like attractive options, particularly to get some capital collected together. I think the struggle historically that GPs find with these is actually getting the yes vote on a deal-by-deal basis. It's all wonderful to say you have a yes or no vote, but when actually investors get their hands on the deal and look at it and scrub it and underwrite it, it seems like a lot of times someone finds something wrong with it and a reason to vote no. So club deals present a challenge, too, in terms of execution. So it remains to be seen whether these will really sort of pick up steam and take hold or whether we'll really revert back to...
Well, it seems like we've been this route in 2001 and had a lot of these push for these various initiatives, and they kind of receded as soon as the market snapped back. I guess what will happen is it'll depend on the market. If we stay in this where we are for a while, then there'll be more momentum on that side. If not, I would imagine we may well revert back to prior terms, prior deals. But just to close, what advice would you be giving GPs, Carl?
Back in 2010, what we'd like to see is some exits through this down cycle. If there's and it's a hard task, I understand, but to see realizations in a down cycle proves to us that you can manage capital in any type of cycle. You can manage it in an up cycle as well as a down cycle. So in 2010, we expect to see quite a few funds in 2010, at least from what we're hearing. There'll be quite a bit of activity from managers coming back in 2010, and if they can show exits and then operating performance at their underlying portfolio company level. If they can show real improvement in earnings, debt pay down, et cetera, that will help us kind of understand how their portfolio performed in the down market. Multiple are starting to expand again back as the public markets come up, so we're kind of probably discount multiple expansion. But if there's real growth in earnings or debt pay down through the cycle, that'll be a positive.
Good to hear. Brett, in terms of just on the sponsor side, I mean, dealing with your LPs, have things changed for you at all?
They have. LPs want more transparency. They want to know more what's going on. They want to have greater interaction with their private equity fund sponsors. I think especially, in a time of uncertainty, reaching out to them before they reach out to you to say, here's what's going on, here's the good, here's the bad, here's the ugly, but we want you to be informed and we want you to know we're here to answer questions, here to provide you the support you need, has been critical. It's made a big difference for them. They're under fire from their boards. They're getting lots of questions. They need data sooner than ever before. They need information, different things. Sometimes the same thing they asked for 2 weeks ago, just formatted differently. And I would tell you that, as an industry, I think we have done not so good of a job being responsive to our LPs. This has been a time where customer service and remembering who your customer is, has been critical. And help them solve some problems, and hopefully we'll strengthen the relationship, from a long-term perspective.
That's great. Well, thank you, everybody. Does anybody have any questions for our panelists? Yes.
How
to repeat the question in case I remember, the question was on the secondary front activity in the hedge fund area.
We've seen private equity coming out of the hedge funds. Many of the hedge funds had a private equity component to it. You mentioned directs. You know, we've seen it's a big part of our practice is buying portfolios of operating companies, either orphaned portfolios or portfolios that were built, you know, inside a financial institution or a strategic, and both the portfolio and the team are looking to spin out. You know, the short answer is if there are assets out there, they've probably come to market in one way, shape, or form, you know, over the past 12 months.
On the hedge fund side, the bulk of the activity has been restructurings within individual hedge funds rather than large institutional LPs selling large portfolios of hedge funds. Or it's been the high net worth segment getting out of their hedge fund exposure. With the gates kind of slowly coming down, I think the need to kind of restructure or sell hedge fund assets will kind of slowly dissipate. On the direct side, there have been a few deals. You know, it's a relatively small portion of the overall market. I think what's out there that could be a meaningful part is a lot of the co-investments that large LPs did with some of the major buyout GPs, just the sheer dollars that they put to work on co-investments. Now, they're not causing the pressure that big unfunded commitments will. There's no additional capital typically required. But I think at some point, the size of those commitments, those co-investments, will trickle through to the secondary market and could be a meaningful part of overall volume.
I mean, we've seen some of those already.
That's great. Anybody else? Yes.
Yes, I come from the compliance side. I'm a compliance officer for a broker-dealer, and we have a lot of rules and regulations that we have to follow by FINRA, and we're also NYSE member. And I remember the hedge fund industry was fighting the idea of being registered and regulated. But today, you know, from a timing point of view, you know, I hear you talk about transparency, but, you know, having standardized rules to make sure that, you know, like in the Bernie Madoff situation, that if, you know, somebody's giving you a statement that there's actual, you know, checks and balances, you know, on, you know, those securities. And there's a whole host of rules and regulations that, you know, FINRA and the NYSE have, and the hedge fund community seems to not have any rules. And I think from a confidence point of view, just using today, you know, you mentioned about the standardization point of view, having, you know, some specific rules that the industry would follow, I think would make sense to help raise money today and confidence.
Well, when you talk about confidence, just as a follow-up, what about registration and private equity regulation? There's been a lot of talk about that. Nothing's really been enacted yet. What are LP's view toward regulating, further regulation of private equity funds?
I think they're generally in support of it. I mean, their advisors oftentimes are regulated. We as Franklin Park are a registered investment advisor, and most of their other managers have an obligation to be registered. So I don't think, though, they've focused on it deep into the weeds. I mean, you ask that question, and they probably say, yeah, we're in favor of it, but they don't know a lot of the ramifications entirely.
Yeah, I would echo that as well. You know, we're a registered SEC investment advisor. That's been important. Clients are looking for that. We just went through a SAS 70 audit, and that is something that, you know, we are constantly being asked about from LPs. You know, tell us about your controls. You know, tell us about, you know, how we get comfortable that, you know, things are what they're supposed to be. So I think that's going to, you know, come much more into the industry going forward.
Do you agree, Fadi?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, I think we're operating under the assumption that, you know, mandatory registration is coming for those who aren't registered, but I think, you know, probably most, at least from the GP perspective, those who aren't registered, they know it's coming, but probably haven't quite completely focused around it, although, you know, probably now is the time to start thinking about it rather than the last minute, because it is a process. But ultimately what gets, I mean, registration at the end of the day is really, most of it is best practices anyhow, and things that LPs are really, even if you weren't registered, we're probably expecting you to do at the end of the day. So it's ultimately going to be, I think, a good thing for the industry.
That's great. Anybody else? Well, I want to thank our panelists for joining us today. Thank you very much. And
Thank you.